The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
This is the signal reason that Merrick Garland wanted to become Attorney General and was willing to give up his position on the D.C. Circuit. We know many, many people who have been hanging on by their fingernails, waiting for this administration to end so that the department can be returned to its roots. And you heard that abundantly in the speeches of the president-elect, the vice-president-elect, Merrick Garland, Lisa Monaco, everyone who spoke when the nominations were made formal. That's the job. In the very first instance, that is the job.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, January 11th, 2021. Jamie Gorelick was Deputy Attorney General under Bill Clinton and Attorney General Janet Reno. In that capacity, she hired as her top aide and adjutant one Merrick Garland. This was before Merrick Garland became a D.C. Circuit judge, but it was a fateful period for the department. A lot happened. The Oklahoma City bombing, for example, after which Jamie Gorelick sent Merrick Garland to Oklahoma to supervise the investigation and resulting prosecution. Gorelick joined me in the virtual jungle studio to talk about Garland's history at the department, his selection as Attorney General, and the team that will surround him. It's the Lawfare Podcast, January 11th, Jamie Gorelick on Merrick Garland and the Justice Department team. So, Jamie, I want to start with you and Merrick Garland go way, way back. And when I first met you both, you were Deputy Attorney General, and he was your kind of, his title was Principal Associate Deputy, but everybody kind of thought of him as Jamie Gorelick's right hand. How did you come to know Merrick Garland, and how did he come to be working for you at the Justice Department?
Merrick and I had known each other since college. We met on a committee to which we were both appointed, I as a junior and he as a freshman, to look at various issues relating to undergraduate life. And it won't surprise you, Ben, that I was crusading for equal rights for women in the university and particularly in the college, on things as diverse as eligibility for fellowships and eligibility for football tickets. And Merrick was the best supporter you could have wanted. He was my wingman and was wonderful in those arguments, many of which I lost, but the fight continued and eventually was won.
And so this was obviously significantly before you came to the Justice Department. How did he end up as your principal associate when you were deputy?
Well, we stayed friends between college and 1994 when I got to the Justice Department. And we were just personal friends and our families were friends. And we always wanted to work together, and there just wasn't an opportunity. So when I was putting together the confirmation process for Janet Reno, I asked Merrick to help with the substantive briefings of the Attorney General. She got to know him right away and saw how terrific he was. He was a key player at the department in the criminal division for that first year when I was general counsel over at DOD. And then when I was brought over to Justice to serve as deputy AG, the most obvious thing to me, particularly since he'd been there for that intervening year and he was as terrific as I knew him to be, was to ask him to be my pay dag.
So I don't mean to speak ill of Janet Reno, whom, as you know, I had high regard for, but it was, I don't think it's speaking ill of the departed to say that she had a tendency toward micromanagement, and that one of the things that you and Merrick had to do in the period in which you were deputy was to kind of have a management layer so that she wasn't focused on the details of every brief that was filed anywhere in the department. Is that an exaggeration, or is that a fair characterization?
She knew herself that the management of the department was off. When she and her then deputy Phil Hyman parted ways, and she called me to ask me if I would consider coming from defense to justice, and I loved being at defense, I asked her what was wrong, what happened. And she said, in essence, both of us wanted to be attorney general. I need somebody to run the place because I am not feeling free to be the ultimate decision maker because I don't feel that the rest of the department is being run. Now, she knew her own tendencies, and there were some actually humorous aspects to those tendencies. But it also was true that Phil, whom I also spoke with, felt that his most important contributions would be at the policy level. And frankly, that department is so sprawling and so horizontal that it absolutely needs a deputy AG who can run it and serve up cleanly to the AG the decisions that only the AG should be making.
So one of the reasons I wanted to talk to you today about Merrick is that he takes over a department that is in crisis. And the full dimensions of that crisis are itself pretty sprawling. And he has extremely deep experience with that department, but it isn't recent experience. And you and he were there at the very beginning of this pivot the department has taken to becoming a real national security component, although it always had elements of that. But, you know, that process has had 25 years when he's been on the bench to, or 20 years while he's been on the bench to mature. And so I'm interested for your thoughts on, you know, if you were to go back to the department or for him to go to the department now, how's it different from the way it was when you guys were there?
Well, let me say a couple of things. To be sure, it is different. I personally have stayed involved in the national security community. I've served on the Defense Policy Board and on the CIA's advisory panel alternately over the intervening 23 years. But Merrick, as you point out, has not. He's been doing other very important things, but he hasn't done that. The good news is that an AG and a deputy AG are meant to be complementary. And you couldn't have a better deputy AG in terms of experience with the national security environment. I mean, Lisa Monaco not only served as head of the National Security Division, also served at the FBI, and then was the key player in the National Security Council on terrorism issues. So I don't have any worry about this. I mean, when I came from defense to justice in 1994, the then AG Janet Reno asked me to make sure that the Department of Justice was connected with the national security agencies, which I did. I set up the first office within the Deputy Attorney General's office for that purpose, recognizing that Reno's predecessor, the recently departed Dick Thornburgh, had tried unsuccessfully to get Congress to allow him to have an assistant attorney general, in essence, for national security. So we couldn't do that. We did the next best thing. So the department's been on a journey since then. I don't have any worry about Merrick's and Lisa's ability to get their arms around these issues.
So I remember quite vividly as a young reporter at Legal Times when the Oklahoma City bombing happened and you dispatched Merrick to Oklahoma City effectively to run the response. Talk about the role that he played, you know, starting the moment the bomb went off.
Well, we were together watching what was happening on television and trying to reach our own departmental resources in Oklahoma City, many of whom were in the Murrah building, which had just been blown up. The marshals had an office there. Any number of DOJ agencies were there. Our main source of information, indeed, was the U.S. Attorney's Office, which was not there. And we were watching this in absolute horror. And Merrick, both of us had young children, and you could see first responders carrying out dead and wounded children from the daycare center that was in the Murrah building. And it was horrible. And you say I dispatched him. That is technically true, but he said, I have to go.
That's interesting. So describe the role that he played there. I mean, it was both an there was kind of an investigative component to it because he was there before, I think he was there before the charges were filed, right?
Oh, way before. I mean, he went right away and got there. I can't remember which day post-bombing, but it was very soon thereafter. We already had some people on the ground. We had the FBI there in force. They had set up a command center. We had a key person from the Executive Office for U.S. Attorneys had gone out right away. But Merrick was there to make sure that the investigation was done right, that we caught the perpetrators, and that we prosecuted them in a way that would be a model for justice in America. You have to remember that this came not long after the O.J. Simpson trial, which made a mockery of prosecutions. It was a joke all over the country. And given the importance of this event, we wanted to make sure that our justice system, which would be on trial itself, was a model. And so Merrick had, that was his most important job, make sure that we apprehended these people who had done this horrific act and prosecute them in a way that would be, my word, bulletproof. That was his number one job. Part of that job involved working cooperatively with the Treasury Department assets that were on the ground. Treasury owned ATF at the time, the multiple state and local, both first responders and law enforcement, the state government of Oklahoma City, the city government. I mean, it was, in addition to everything else, a massive diplomatic job. Now, I helped. Back home, I was on the phone regularly with a lot of those same players, but he was on the front lines.
I cannot imagine a better preparation for being Attorney General in a situation of a significant terrorist or national security event than that? I mean, obviously, it would be different if it were an international incident. It would be different in character if it were a cyber incident. But there's something about the experience of having to think through the investigative equities, the prosecutorial equities, the other equities, and also the O.J. Simpson equities, which is to say, you know, how do you do it in a way that's going to not merely stand up in court, but be seen to stand up in court? You know, there's a lot of the post 9/11 problems that are kind of embedded in that experience. Yeah,
totally. You know, I didn't even mention the number of U.S. attorneys' offices that were involved and had competing claims, if you will,
as well as the state law enforcement. I mean, Oklahoma tried to,
right,
you know, get custody of one of the defendants.
We had to work very hard with each of the, let's just call them stakeholders. We had a massive FBI investigation that crossed jurisdictions all over the country. So I would say that this experience was a good training for Merrick, but also really shows his incredible strengths. I mean, he brought a combination of expertise and passion to this that just made you proud.
So I want to skip over his entire judicial career, not because it's not important or for most people's purposes, the principal thing about which people talk to him, but because it's actually less relevant to running the Justice Department.
Well, can I say one thing about that? I do think that one of the things that the president and the vice president get in Merrick Garland is someone who is revered within the judiciary.
Yes.
And highly respected by judges and justices appointed by both parties. I think that when he decides on a course of action in the courts, he will bring his own credibility to the Justice Department's positions. And that is no small thing.
I agree with that completely. It was one of the reasons that I think I'm the first person to have publicly suggested this course for the president and the president-elect back before the election. And that was one of the things that was very much on my mind, like who could be the Ed Levy of our time? And his judicial career is a big part of that. And just to foot stomp your point about the reverence with which he is held among colleagues on the bench, I'm at liberty to tell this story because unfortunately Judge Williams passed away of COVID earlier this year. But Judge Stephen Williams, who was one of Merrick's colleagues on the D.C. Circuit, told me that at the time that he returned to the court after he was then chief judge, after his 2016 nomination, and he came back into a conference or a lunch of the judges, and there was a sort of impromptu standing ovation for him of all of the sitting and senior judges, irrespective of party. And so I do think, you know, the litigation posture of the United States is a different matter if it's in the hands of somebody who judges have worked with and really respect and like and trust as a matter of sort of personal integrity.
I mean, that's consistent with everything I have ever heard. If I could add just a little bit to that, Larry Silberman and I were ready as soon as Merrick was renominated for the Supreme Court by Hillary Clinton to storm the Capitol and try to convince people of both parties, senators of both parties, to confirm him. You know, Larry was as fiercely in Merrick's corner as I was. And I know that, you know, we've seen wonderful comments about Merrick from Justice Kavanaugh and Justice Roberts and others with whom he has served. But anyway, I just wanted Ben not to pass over too quickly his judicial career.
I completely agree with you. I want to talk about some of the challenges he's going to face. And, you know, people, I think, have gotten inured to hearing folks like me talk about the degree of crisis in the department. But I can't think of a time, certainly not in the post-Watergate era, in which an attorney general will get confirmed, will have simultaneously a sort of unfolding national security, pair of national security incidents in the storming of the Capitol and in the SolarWinds situation, combined with a really gross loss of confidence in the part of both courts and the public in the way the department has conducted itself. And so I'm just interested in your thoughts as somebody who's been deputy attorney general. How would you scope the problem that Merrick Garland and Lisa Monaco are going to face on day one when they take over the department?
This is the signal reason that Merrick Garland wanted to become attorney general and was willing to give up his position on the DC circuit. We know many, many people who have been hanging on by their fingernails, waiting for this administration to end so that the department can be returned to its roots. And you heard that abundantly in the speeches of the president-elect, the vice president-elect, Merrick Garland, Lisa Monaco, everyone who spoke when the nominations were made formal. That's the job. In the very first instance, that is the job.
How do you do it?
Well, you do it by making decisions based on the facts and the law. You do it by returning to the norms by which or under which the department has been operating for decades, with with the exception of recent times. And you do it in what you say and in your external communications. I expect that you'll hear quite a bit of this from Merrick in his confirmation hearing.
My principal worry for him is that the times are so polarized that it is impossible, even for somebody who actually has a legitimate claim to be an above politics figure, to be one. That the Jim Jordans of the world will announce in a kind of malicious ipsy dixit in, you know, 3-4 weeks from now that Merrick Garland is the most partisan attorney general in American history, and that Fox News will pick that up. And, you know, it's not a say it 3 times and it's true thing, but it is a say it 300 times and it's true for 40% of the electorate thing. And I'm curious whether you think the norms of the Justice Department and, you know, standing by them and being prepared to defend in public in a serious way the consistency with the way we've traditionally expected the Justice Department to behave, whether that is actually enough in this environment to not merely keep the department apolitical, but to keep the department or apolitical in the sense that it is traditionally apolitical, but to actually convince people that it is so.
So I have 3 comments about that. Number one, there are many people within the incoming administration who revere the Justice Department and who will speak for it. Ron Klain served with us. He was chief of staff to the attorney general for part of our tenure, and he knows this issue really, really well. And there are a number of other people in senior staff positions who are similarly reverential about the department. And then, of course, there is the president-elect himself. I mean, the sanctity of the Department of Justice, the necessity for it to play the independent role that President-elect Biden has articulated both in the campaign and in nominating Merrick Garland, he knows this, and it is a key part of why he ran for office. So I expect lots of support coming from that end of Pennsylvania Avenue. And then there are many people who are either former federal prosecutors or former state prosecutors who can articulate this as well. I expect to hear from Dick Blumenthal. I expect to hear from Amy Klobuchar. I expect to hear from Sheldon Whitehouse. I expect to hear from people like Cory Booker and others who know the department and know the role that it needs to play. They will be fierce defenders because they saw what happened when those norms were broken. Reestablishing norms is hard.
Yeah, it really is.
And I agree with you, Ben, that there will be ruthless and unprincipled attacks on Merrick Garland and Lisa Monaco and the entire set of people who have been nominated and dispatched to the Department of Justice. But the rest of us need to speak up. And I certainly intend to, and I know many others will.
Well, as you have things to write, we of course hope you will write them for Lawfare. I want to talk about the other members of the team who were announced yesterday, some of whom are more relevant to a national security-oriented legal site than others. But I do think, for reasons I'll describe, they're all worth talking about a little bit. So let's start with Lisa Monaco, who is pretty well known to the Lawfare reading and listening community. I said on Twitter the other day pretty much exactly what you just said about her, which is that it's very hard to imagine somebody whose particular skill set at this stage and particular expertise more perfectly complements Merrick, specifically with the recent very granular and very diverse national security experience, both at the department and in the interagency process through the White House. And, people forget this about Lisa, that she was Bob Mueller's chief of staff at the Bureau and therefore, has some investigative agency experience that's pretty rare, actually, among national security legal practitioners. I'm curious. I mean, you've said some nice things about her earlier today. I'm curious for your sense of how deliberate this sort of complementarity of their backgrounds was on the part of the president-elect and his team.
It was very conscious. I mean, Lisa has played a role in the transition that has been very, very helpful. I think the president-elect knows her well, both from her tenure in the White House, but also from her work in the transition. And from my discussions with the people who were making these decisions, the two of them are viewed as highly complementary. I mean, I have said about Lisa that she has sat at many of the relevant seats around the table. I mean, I got to know her when she was chief of staff to Janet Reno. So she's worked at the top of the department. She's worked for Bob Mueller, and you couldn't have had a better tutor in the workings of law enforcement than Bob, nor a better model. You know, her work in what was then a reasonably nascent national security division is very important. And then, of course, her work in the White House. If you look right now at the threats to our country, they are at the seams. They are at the seam of domestic terrorism and criminal prosecution. They are at the seams of foreign threats and domestic threats. If you look at the SolarWinds matter, I think what we will find is that our foreign enemies have realized that we have different rules for the surveillance and counterattack of threats that are outside the United States than we do for those that are inside, and they manage to attack us from the outside, from the inside. And we're going to see similar issues surrounding the siege on the Capitol. They're tremendously complementary, and they will work well together. I mean, Merrick's model is the model of, you know, Reno and Gorelick, in which the DAG is playing the inside game, is yes. working the department, is making sure that issues that could nip up and bite you are identified early and addressed well. Lisa has both the knowledge of the department and, importantly, the temperament to do this, because this job, the Deputy Attorney General's job, requires, if you do it well, to make hard decisions pretty much every 15 minutes.
I think that point is so important, and I think people who are not intimate with the department as an institution won't intuit how big a difference it is from the way things have operated for at least the last couple of years, where, you know, the Deputy Attorney General has been, I don't know how to say this politely, maybe something of a non-entity, and the Attorney General has been a immensely powerful personality who's reaching down into, you know, line level individual cases in order to second guess the department's position. You know, that is an extraordinary thing, and it is not the way the department should work, right?
So the way, Ben, the department should work, in my view, to operate at its best is for the Deputy Attorney General to ensure that decision-making with respect to issues that either are ordinarily coming up to the deputy and AG, or those that really should come up to them, are addressed fully by all the different relevant voices within the department being heard, and decisions taken with all of those considerations in mind. If you do it right, many of the things that would otherwise go to the AG are dealt with at the deputy AG level, because once you get all the voices around the table, decisions are either self-evident, that is, one side goes away, or the decision can be made readily by the deputy AG. There are big things that need to be done. Those big things cannot be done if the AG is nibbled by ducks. And it will be Lisa's job to make sure the ducks are in order. And I think she will be great at that. I would just point out that the Department of Justice is as horizontal an organization as you will see anywhere, let alone in government. I came to justice from defense, which is very vertical. Just the Deputy Attorney General has oversight of all 93 U.S. Attorney's offices, all of the marshals, all the investigative agencies like the FBI, the Bureau of Prisons, and all manner of grant making and other functions, and all the litigating divisions of the department. The only intermediary set of oversight processes are that the Associate Attorney General, at least traditionally, has had oversight in the first instance of the civil litigating divisions, right, and some of the grant making. But that is a huge span of control. And one of the reasons that I had Merrick Garland, Seth Waxman, David Ogden, people who were my peers in essence, as my deputies is because I knew that I could not myself make every single decision in a timely way. And I'll be speaking with Lisa about this shortly, but I think that she is going to need to have serious, serious deputies who can say, this is what Lisa wants and mean it.
And she has also been one of those deputies in the deputy's office at the beginning of the Obama administration. Before she went to NSD, she was the person in the deputy's office who, kind of oversaw NSD. So she, I think, has a certain savvy about the way, as does Merrick, about the way the deputy's office functions, right?
Yes, I agree.
Normally, I would say, hey, the associate attorney general and the head of the civil rights division are kind of beyond the scope of Lawfare's traditional concerns. But I think, the last few years of matters related to police violence and, frankly, election integrity and voter suppression have given rise to a sense of them as more within our jurisdiction than we've thought of them in the past. And in that context, the other two members of the Justice Department team announced yesterday, Vanita Gupta for Associate Attorney General and Kristen Clark at the Civil Rights Division, seemed to me important to talk about too. They both come from rather different worlds than Lisa and Merrick in terms of their, they're both civil rights lawyers. And yet there seems to be, at least in my judgment, a real coherence to what the president-elect seems to be trying to do here. What are your thoughts on the two of them?
Well, first, Ben, I'm not going to comment on the Lawfare jurisdiction.
Well, the Lawfare jurisdiction is subject to my unreviewable discretion. I would just say, historically, we've always thought of national security law pretty broadly, but only recently have I thought, hey, we should be thinking seriously about local policing issues insofar as a lot of people are being shot. And this year, the ability to hold an election in the context of a pandemic has really forced us to think about election law, including a whole series of voting rights issues in a way that we've never thought of it as within Lawfare's ambit before.
Yeah. So let me make a couple of comments. FBI Director Chris Wray has identified domestic terrorism as one of the great threats to our country. So if you're just looking at what are the national security threats to the United States, you have to include domestic terrorism of the sort that we saw this week.
Yep.
You have to include the ability to hold an election, whether the threat comes from Russian interference or the efforts, in essence, to destabilize and delegitimize our election processes. I've worked with Vanita Gupta when she was acting assistant AG in the Civil Rights Division, and since. She is a very serious, thoughtful person. She knows the department well, and she is absolutely 100% committed to civil rights. Now, she will have other issues within her domain, but she is going to make sure that the civil rights agenda is front and center. Kristen Clark is a pro, and she is as passionate about these issues as you would expect her to be. So I think that's a pretty dynamic duo. I also think that this is going to be front and center for Merrick Garland and Lisa Monaco. They know how important these issues are to the sense of well-being in this country, to our most important values. Both of them spoke themselves to this in their remarks accepting their nominations. And so I think this is going to be a very dynamic team. And if you look at the interests of the United States and the values that are embedded in the Department of Justice, this is a team that will protect us from the most heinous attacks that we have experienced as a country. and advance the cause of civil rights.
Jamie Gorelick, it's great to talk to you, and thanks so much for joining us.
Well, you're welcome, Ben. I'm glad to be here, and I'm glad to know that you are the place to go to when I want to challenge the limited jurisdiction of Lawfare.
Please do. Although, as I said, it requires no challenge at this point. We're to the extent that the jurisdiction was too narrow, it is broadening every day.
That's a good coda. Thank you, Ben.
Thank you. The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Our audio engineer this episode is Ian Enright of Goat Rodeo. You should do your part to promote the Lawfare Podcast. Tweet us, share us on Facebook and Twitter. Rate us and review us in whatever podcast distribution service you found us on. Our merch is available at thelawfarestore.com. The Lawfare Podcast is produced and edited by Jen Patya Howell. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. And as always, thanks for listening.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.